Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, welcome along. It's the Writer's Routine Podcast. Every week right here, we chat to a top author and we try and learn the secrets of their working day. You know, to try and help our own floundering attempts to become a writer. This week, we're chatting to Paul Burston. He's an author, a journalist, he was a founding editor of Attitude magazine, he holds writing classes, and he's just moved into crime fiction with his book released in 2016 called The Black Path. Now, we talk about how he moved between voices, between tenses and tones. We'll get tips on the best way of unclogging your writer's block, and also we'll hear about the in-depth, dedicated and tireless research that he did for his first book.
In those days, I was quite, how do I put this? I had quite a few compulsions in those
would
days.
Would hedonistic be a term?
Yes, hedonistic is a very good way of putting it. I was very hedonistic in those days.
That's with Paul Burston on the way in this week's Writer's Routine. Yes, hello, thank you so much for downloading. My name is Dan Simpson. This is Writer's Routine. Now, I've been thinking a lot recently all about how books massively affect emotions. I know that seems like quite a quaint and naive statement to make, really, but you see, over the winter, I find myself vociferously reading far more than I do at any other point of the year, and I've been kind of thinking about why. You see, the secret, I'm a dreadfully slow reader in real life. I think one of the reasons that I do this podcast to help me get better at writing is because I'm so distracted while I sit down at my laptop to try and pen my own work. And it's kind of the same as reading, really. I don't know if this is the same for you. You're probably a much better reader than I am. I kind of read a paragraph, see something interesting in that paragraph. Then I kind of go into a dream world thinking about that. Maybe I'll open my phone, get on Google, Wikipedia, whatever it is I've learnt there. And then I kind of keep doing this cycle. It takes me so long. But over the winter, I churn through books, and I've been kind of mulling this over, and I reckon it's because of two reasons. Number one, it's kind of the obvious one. It's cold. You can't go out as much. There's not as many opportunities to lie in beer gardens all day as there is in summer, so there isn't as much to do. You kind of curl up with a book by the fire from a 1940s Christmas film. And two, I think this really hits home for me as well. I think the dark, the cold, it kind of affects my mood somewhat. I get like a little bit down and lethargic over the winter, and I seek solace in the comfort and the characters of my favourite books and ones I don't know yet as well. And it's made me really reflect upon how brilliant mood shifters books are. You know, when I'm down, they help get me up. They calm me down as well. I'd love to hear about you, though. What books do you use to shift your mood? I don't know, be it happy, whether you're sad, whether you're excited, you need to be calmed down, whether you're a bit melancholy and you want something magnificent. Just do me a favour, tell me the books that do it for you, that help shift your mood. You can send me a message over at writersroutine.com. Also, very quickly, while I'm talking to you about ways that you can get in touch with the show, remember, it would be grand if you could leave Writer's Routine a review on the iTunes podcast store. That way we can make this show become something kind of really important, special, and get momentum building along the way. 5 stars and some nice words on there always helps as well. Then I can know that you're listening and that you're loving what we're doing. We can get more authors involved there as well. We can get more people listening and all that lovely stuff. So yeah, do me a favour, just get over to the iTunes podcast store, find Writer's Routine and leave us a review. Now, our guest on the show this week is Paul Burston. He's a journalist, an author. He was one of the founding editors of Attitude magazine. He runs a writing salon as well. It's called Polari, and he takes it all over the country to impart his own writing wisdom. But you don't need to travel anywhere for it right now. Just keep listening to this show. His first novel was published in 2001, called Shameless, and it's all about the kind of Soho clubbing scene at that time. And to write that, he had to research it naturally, and that meant doing a lot in the Soho clubbing scene of the time. And to be honest, I don't get the impression that that was really too tough a task for him. Now, in March 2016, he was featured in a global list by the British Council as one of 33 visionary people who are promoting freedom, equality and LGBT rights all around the world. And later on that year, he published his first crime novel. It's called The Black Path, and it's all about the army, about being gay in there, and about living in South Wales and being a military wife. You'll hear loads more about that in the show. Now, our distinguished diary this week, by the way, is with the Lord of Horror, the Flies, and I don't know, maybe even The Dance as well, who I've never seen him at a party. Stephen King will get his weird and wonderful writer's routine in just a little bit. First, let's get into today's guest then, the author Paul Burston, who finds himself being inspired all the time by other books.
I find that if I don't read regularly, that my writing brain sort of atrophies, and I find that I have to read. It's sort of feeding the whatever part of the brain it is that is producing the words. I think that the rhythms of other, you have to be careful not to sort of absorb them too much, because then you start repeating them. But I think the rhythms of writing kind of get stuck in your head, and then you realize how you can apply certain sounds or certain construction to what you're working on. So I often find other people's work inspires me quite in a positive way. I think I'm a magpie. I think I take little bits from here and there and everywhere, and sort of they go into a sort of into a process, and they come out as something else. So I don't think I'm ever sort of aping or imitating anyone sort of slavishly. I just think that there are certain things that you learn about how you know what sort of risks you can take, what kind of different ways of presenting something, and then just a straightforward narrative perhaps, or where it might be useful to break something up by having dialogue or whatever it might be. And often you'll be stuck on something, and you'll see someone else fix that find the solution to that problem. It's about finding solutions to problems, really. And you know what your story is when you start writing your book, or at least you should. I think you should have a rough idea what your story is when you start writing a book. And you may well sort of deviate slightly from the original path, and I certainly don't always stick rigorously to a plan. I write one, but I often go wildly off it. But it's still my story. So anything else that happens along the way is just going to inspire me in sort of small ways. It's not going to take over the main, you know, the main piece. It has a life of its own.
And you say that you do start with a plan. You quite often, as I found out doing this, that all writers could deviate very quickly from the path. But so say with the latest book that you had published, which was The Black Path.
Yeah.
What was the initial idea that you had for that? And what did it end up becoming? And how did it change along the way?
The initial idea was, I'm from a town called Bridgend in South Wales. It's a very, very big army recruitment town. It's one of those towns that sort of seen better days, and at the weekend it's quite kind of, it can be quite scary. Lots of people with not much to do apart from get drunk, and the town is quite kind of dilapidated now. So part of the idea was to write about somebody coming from that town, which I came from many, many years ago. And the second thing that happened was that I met this soldier called James Wharton, who was the first gay soldier to appear on the cover of Soldier magazine, and we met at a charity event, and I was fascinated by some of the stories he told about when he was serving in Iraq with Prince Harry. He wrote a book called Out in the Army later on about all these experiences, and those two ideas sort of came together. So I thought, what if this soldier came from my town and was serving in Afghanistan? And the other main character, which was Helen, was partly inspired by my sister, my younger sister Jacqueline, and partly inspired by some other women that I knew from when I grew up, who all ended up as being soldiers' wives. So the original idea was it was a story about a soldier's wife, And it was really her sort of journey from being a kind of quite sort of put upon, downtrodden person to being a sort of braver person. I didn't realise at the start that I was actually... I thought it was going to be a sort of rite of passage novel. I didn't realise it was going to become a thriller until I started writing it. So I plotted it quite carefully, I just didn't realise what the tone was. So the first draft of the first few chapters was so awful. The tone was completely awful. It was completely wrong. And I realised after... I'm in a writing group. I meet with two other writers every week and we go through our work together. And I think we on our third or fourth session, they both said, you do realise this is a thriller. You're trying to write a thriller and you're not really letting it come out properly. So I went back and changed it all. And then it did go off the original path, so to speak. It did go in different directions.
So you're in your writing group, mm-hmm. and you're told that this is actually a thriller. You've got the voice of a thriller screaming to come out here. But how do you change that then? Because surely then you've got to think about the tropes of a thriller, the standard narrative voice of a thriller, and kind of help that come through.
To be honest with you, it wasn't a question of rewriting hugely. It was a question of taking things out. Because my background is as a journalist. So as a journalist, you have a tendency to want to explain everything to the reader and let them know everything. And of course, that's what you shouldn't do when you're writing a book of that kind. So I had to go back and take things out, edit. It was a really hard edit, really. It was just doing a really hard edit on the first five, six chapters. And after that, the tone, kind of the voice found itself then. If I read a thriller or I read a book and at the end there's a twist, which is basically that someone's been lying the entire time, I feel cheated. It has to be cleverer than that. So there has to be reason for it. You know, you can't just be somebody that they're a liar. Unless, of course, you're double bluffing. So you've got a character who's clear. I mean, I've got a character in this new book who's clearly an unreliable narrator. And that's obvious very early in the story. But that isn't the point. And if that were the twist, it would be pretty lame.
I read my first unreliable narrator story the other day, actually. I think the most famous one. Oh, it's the Poirot one. And I wasn't that bothered by that. Because I think it's, you know, it's like history, isn't it?
That's true. I think it's a question of, you know, there's a time and a place, and there are many, many great books written, but, you know, over the years, even quite recent ones, where that works, and the fact that the narrator has been unreliable is a twist and does take you by surprise and make you question what you've read before and all that stuff. I just think that sometimes it can feel a little bit like cheating.
It's an easy get out, isn't it?
It can feel a bit like cheating sometimes. I think that readers of these books are much cleverer than people give them credit for. I think that, you know, if they, a lot of them read an awful lot of books, and if people are reading all those books, you can't just be yet another story where there's the same, you know, the same modus operandi. I just think it becomes a little bit slack and a bit lazy.
So how do you make sure then, as an author, that your work is not wallpaper, it's not window dressing, it's going to stand out?
For me personally, I think that the characters have to come first. I think that you can have a really good story, you can have a really good, clever plot, you can have a really great twist, but I think if the characters aren't living and breathing and three-dimensional and empathetic, if not always sympathetic, then I think you've got less to give the reader. I think I don't like to read books that are all plot and no character, even though I could admire them technically speaking. I think if the characters don't really sort of ring true, or I don't feel that they're people that I recognise, I always start from a position of who's my main character and what is the challenge that they're going to face. That's how I always start. And then the plot kind of comes out of that. Rather than saying, here's my plot and what character shall I fit into that? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. You're building a believable character and then dropping them in a situation.
And the situation, you know, should be a situation that is going to somehow show this character at their best or worst. And then from that, you can leap off in all kinds of directions.
So with the book you're writing at the moment...
Mm-hmm.
And you say it's in many voices and across a few tenses as well. Tell me about the plotting of that then, because I'd imagine something that does flip-flop, it changes voice fairly often. It requires you as a writer to be on top of things, to know exactly what's going on when.
Yeah.
How have you gone about plotting and planning this?
Lots of post-it notes at the beginning. I did do a board. You know, I have a board in my office as well, which I sort of pin cards on. So I did a sort of storyboard for it. I knew that the first person narrator was probably the most important voice to get down first. So I did that first, and I wrote the entire piece. Because it's a first person, because you do find yourself going off on flights of fancy, you know, you do find yourself being taken in places you didn't think you were going to go, because you're inside that character's head, and they become quite real. Well, they become very real to you when you're writing. So once I'd finished that, the chapters that were going to go in between, i.e. the other characters' chapters, changed quite a bit to fit. There's also some quite black comedy in it at points. There are some quite funny bits where you're invited to laugh at the gap between somebody's perception of themselves and how the reader is perceiving them.
And have you planned that comedy, or is it just as...
No, that totally came out of the character. I started off with a character that was partly based on a real life incident. I had a stalker some years ago, and he went to court. So it started off, that was part of the inspiration for this story. And at the beginning, my feelings about that person were quite hostile. And as I've written the book, they've changed. So I am quite good or quite open to looking back at certain things and thinking, well, did I really behave the best way I could have done? And could I have handled that better than I did? And all that kind of stuff. You know, as a writer, well, so as a fiction writer, I don't think you can call yourself a writer unless you're able to try and put yourself in somebody else's mind. And doing that invariably means you're going to find points of entry with that character. You're going to find ways of trying to understand what they did rather than condemn them for what they did. If all you did as a novelist was condemn your characters, your books wouldn't be living things.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Remember, you can get updates on this show. You can get clips from all our episodes so far. You can get pictures from interviews with some of your favourite authors by just giving us a follow on Instagram. We are Writers Routine on there. Also, you can find us on Twitter. It's at Writers Routine. And we've got a website too, writersroutine.com. It's where you can listen to loads of old episodes. You can find all the ways that you can subscribe to the show. And also, you can get in touch with us there as well. It's online over at writersroutine.com. Right, let's do Distinguished Diary then. This is our weekly look at some of the weird and wonderful writing routines of the most successful authors. Today, it's Stephen King. Stephen King, the horror man. You know, him off The Shining, It, Carrie. I really could go on, honestly. If I did nothing more right now than just list all the books that he's had published, this would be the longest episode of the Writer's Routine yet. Anyway, Stephen, he aims to write 6 pages a day. You notice with American writers, actually, whereas Brits work with a word count, every American author that I've spoken to always deals in pages. And King, he tries to write six every single day, because then he figures out he can pretty much get a whole book done in around about 2 months. Well, the first draft of it anyway. And he says that's only if it goes well. He says that quite pointedly, as if most of the time it doesn't always go that well. And it usually takes him around 4 hours to do those six pages every single day. He says that he wakes up with a cup of tea, and then between 8 and 8.30 in the morning, he'll sit down to write in the same place every day. He has a vitamin pill with him, he sticks his music on, and he just sits there in the same seat until he gets the work done. All the papers as well are arranged in exactly the same way every day. He's got a brilliant turn of phrase to kind of describe this ritual, this routine. You'd expect nothing else really, but a brilliant turn of phrase from Stephen King. It tells us why he keeps to this pattern. He says the cumulative purpose of doing these things the same way every day, it seems to be a way of saying to his mind, you're going to be dreaming soon. You're going to be lost in fantasy. You're going to be deep into your work. And I mean, Stephen King, he's written over 50 novels, had over 350 million books sold. He dreams a lot. Extremely successful dreams, too. Oh, very quickly, before we get into part two, if you love Stephen King, by the way, or you know someone that's a massive King and horror fan, let them know what's on the way in the next few weeks on Writer's Routine. Stephen King has just released a book and published it with his son, Owen. It's called Sleeping Beauties, and I'm getting Owen King on this show to chat to him about his daily writing routine really soon. Let's get back to it then. Part two of our interview with today's author, journalist and satirist turned crime writer, Paul Burston. And I'm keen to know a lot more about his writing routine, particularly his plotting and how he knows what's happening when.
If I'm writing chapter two, I'll know what's happening in chapter three, and I'll have a rough idea of what's happening in chapter four, and maybe one plot point for chapter five. And what happens is that as you get to the end of chapter two and you see chapter three more clearly and you see chapter four slightly more clearly and chapter five, it sort of goes like that.
So it's almost like you're travelling down a foggy road almost.
Yeah, definitely. That's a really good metaphor. It does feel like that. It does feel like that. And that sometimes you... The frustrating bit, and also the fun bit, because they do come together, is that when you think you know where you're going and then suddenly something happens and you realise you're going the wrong way, or a character, when you're channeling these characters, when one of your characters sort of suggests, let's not go there, let's go down here instead, and you realise that actually that's a much more interesting way to go, even though it means you need to rethink things quite a bit and rejig them, it's fun because that's where it really takes on a life of its own. If you get too precious about your storyboard or your whatever, however you've planned it out, if you get too precious about that and are too sort of fixed about where you're going and refuse to be flexible, I think it ends up dying on you. You end up with a sort of, you're dragging a kind of dead book around with you. You have to let it live, and you have to have faith in it that when, you know, it's only your subconscious, isn't it, at the end of the day? But when your subconscious is saying, let's go here, there's a reason for that.
And
so follow it and see where it takes you.
And you believe that's why it's happening? You think that it's because your brain is kind of working over this story while you're doing other things?
Absolutely. I know it is. I know that for a fact. I know that because I know whenever I get the writer's block, I've learned now that... The thing to do when that happens is not worry about it. Just go and do something else, and it'll work itself. It'll work its way out. Go to the gym. Go for a walk. Just do something completely not related to what the, you know, to what the writing is. For me personally, I find exercise helps enormously. So I'll get up in the morning and I'll write for 2, 3, 4 hours, and I'll go to the gym, or I'll go for a run. And
what time are you getting up in the morning to do this?
Usually about 7.
And are you writing from 7?
I usually just make a cup of coffee and sit straight down. I don't even talk to anyone. I can be quite antisocial first thing in the morning.
So then you've done your 3 or 4 hours, then you've gone to the gym?
Yeah.
And then...
I am that strange person on the treadmill with their phone tapping away, but I'm not texting, I'm actually writing, because I'll be on the treadmill and suddenly I'll be like, that's what that... And so it might just be a couple of words or a sentence or a phrase or a note to myself of what I need to do when I get back home. And because my gym is 5 minutes from here. So I will literally tap that onto my phone in form of an email or in my notes and just, you know, send it to myself. And then I'll come home and I'll work it through and add it to what I'm doing. And then I might work for a few more hours in the afternoon.
So you're a bit of a Renaissance man. You do a lot of different things.
Yes.
And then, so is that the only time you're writing? You're writing from 7 till about, I don't know, 10, 11, then you're writing again in the afternoon?
It depends where what stage I'm at. So on the whole, yes. If I'm near completion, like I'm at the moment with this book, then I tend to write more. So I may well do some this evening as well. And I tend to find as you get towards the end of the book, it's almost like going down a hill, and you have to sort of like, you know, get it all out because you can feel it. You can feel it running away from you. And so I tend to write more. I tend to find that the words come out more quickly towards the end. The tendency then, of course, is to rush it. So you have to sort of stop yourself from rushing. But otherwise, I'm quite disciplined and I just stick to the allotted times. I try, if I can, to fit and end whatever time of day it is that I'm working until, to end where at a place where I'm happy, not with a problem. So that when I go back to it the next morning, I know it's going to start off on a positive note. Because I can't bear going back and starting on a problem. It's just horrible.
I think that's probably the issue, isn't it? Because then you just don't want to pick up the pen again.
Absolutely.
So have you decided in your mind that morning when you've woken up at what point you'll be working to? Is it a time issue? Is it a word count issue?
No, I mean, I used to have a word count. I used to aim for, you know, 500 or 1,000, whatever it was, words a day. Nowadays, I don't really worry so much about that. I just worry about how many of those words are actually going to still survive the night, you know? Because sometimes, you know, you can see, I know people who can literally write, you know, thousands of words in a day. And I have, on occasion, when I'm on a first draft, written large amounts. But then most of that doesn't survive the second edit. So
have you tried to be more economical now? Because I've spoken to some authors again who are very keen to just get anything out. You can always cut, but you can't. It's much easier to cut than it is to add.
Yes.
Now you're six books. Are you on your sixth book now?
My sixth novel,
It's your sixth novel now. Apologies. Are you trying to be more economical and wiser about it to save yourself time?
I think it's partly that. And I think it's partly that, you know, the more you do it, it does get easier. I mean, sometimes it doesn't feel like that. And sometimes you still sit there facing a screen and thinking, I can't do this. And you know you can, because there's the evidence on your bookshelf. There's the books you've published already sitting there proudly waving at you. My worst day is when I sit down and I have, say, 3 hours work and I've got maybe a couple of hundred words to show for it. That's so frustrating because it feels like such a waste of time. But what I always find nearly every single time is that the next day you'll do double the amount because everything that wasn't working on Monday will suddenly process through the night and will all come out on Tuesday. So it doesn't really matter, that it balances out. You know, you end up getting the words done anyway.
As you say, on your sixth novel, how it's changed since your first. So that would have been Shameless.
Yes.
Try and talk me through your average day from waking up to going to sleep, at whatever time that was, of writing Shameless.
It was very different to how it works now. I was working as a journalist full-time then. I used to write maybe for an hour in the morning. But my lifestyle was very different. It was nearly 20 years ago. It was published in 2001. So, yeah, 16 years ago. I was out a lot in those days at night. I'm more of an early bird. I tend to be more sort of early to bed and up early nowadays. Those days I used to be a night owl, so I often used to come in from bars or clubs and sit down and write for an hour. And that book is sort of about that lifestyle anyway. It's sort of set in clubland, and I was sort of living that book as I was writing it. A lot of it was based on personal experience. That book, a lot of it was based on the experience of people around me. When I first moved into this building in 1995, where we're sitting now, there was a guy over the hall, and he became the inspiration for the main character because of what happened to him. So a lot of the story was based on him. A lot of it was based on the people I was meeting on the club scene. So it was a very different process. It was a bit more journalistic in a way, that book. It was a bit sort of like an impressionistic journalistic novel about a world, and it was a black comedy. It was a sort of satire about that sort of looking for love in all the wrong places, sort of lifestyle. But also my lifestyle changed. In those days, I was quite, how do I put this? I had quite a few compulsions in those days.
Would hedonistic be a term?
Yes, hedonistic is a very good way of putting it. I was very hedonistic in those days. I'm not so much now. So when you're hedonistic, the writing takes a different shape and it occupies a different place in your daily routine.
And how long did that take you to write? If you were writing, I don't know, a few hours in the morning and a few then again in the evening, and you had a full day of work, partying, and
I think from the time I started writing it to the time I'd finished it was probably close to 3 years.
Wow.
2.5 years maybe. There was a lot of research. And a lot of the research had a negative effect on the actual writing.
Okay. It's fine. You're 6 novels down now. It kind of all worked out. So I'm interested in, because I know that possibly people will listen who have got a book but don't know then what to do. How did you go about getting that out there and published?
Well, I mean, I was very fortunate. I had a deal already for a non-fiction book with Little Brown. And
this wasn't a non-fiction book?
Not officially, no. And my editor at the time was very keen for me to write. It was his suggestion that I write a novel. So I didn't have to sort of go hawking it around. I already had someone, you know, they'd already said they were interested and, you know, would I write something? We discussed it in great detail what the book was going to be. They knew what to expect. I think it may have been a little bit more hedonistic than they thought, and maybe a little bit more outrageous than they thought. But they were very, very supportive, and they really enjoyed it, and they liked it. So that was all fine. We do these writing workshops as part of our touring with Polari, my literary event that I run. And one thing I say to people all the time is, it's, you know, writing is a really, really lonely activity. And you can feel very isolated, especially if you don't have a publisher, you don't have an agent, an editor, sort of, you know, buoying you up and encouraging you. It can be quite difficult. And I think what I would advise everyone to do is to sort of find some kind of support group of fellow writers. Try and hook up with other writers, even if it's, you know, if they're not physically in your location, in your area of the country, then find them online. But I think to have some kind of sense of a community of writers really helps you. I couldn't write now without my support group. I couldn't write without my writing group. I couldn't write without the people that I first give my stuff, I first show my work to. I couldn't do it without them. I think you need, well, I personally need that. I think it's very important to my process that there are people giving me feedback.
That is it then. Another episode of Writer's Routine done in the bag, downloadable on iTunes and all good podcast providers. Thanks so much to Paul Burston for coming on the show. His novel, The Black Path, it's out right now, and you can also get a handy link for his stuff, his website, all of that on my site, which is writersroutine.com. Remember as well, give us a follow on Twitter and Instagram. You can also email the show at writersroutine@gmail.com. Please as well, leave us a review on iTunes. 5 stars is amazing. Drop me your name on there as well so I know that you're listening and you're loving what we're doing. And while you're there too, be sure to subscribe, because I promise you don't want to miss next week's episode. We're chatting to one of Britain's biggest radio DJs, and he's a podcast hero as well. He's one of the kings of the platform. He's from the BBC Radio 2 Drive Time show, him off of The Confessions, and he's one half of Wittertainment with Mark Kermode. So yeah, make sure you are here next week. We will say hello to Jason Isaacs and talk about Itch with Simon Mayo. Yeah, that's next week on Writer's Routine. I'll see you then. Bye.